Which is, I know they're your friends and Daniel's my cousin and shit, but, like, are they sick? Just the thought of doing something with that house had them squealing like a bunch of nuns at a flasher. I shrugged. They like the place. Why? I mean, it's a total dive. It doesn't even have heating, and they act like it's some kind of palace. Do they not realise what they could get out of it if they just got a grip? That house has potential. Executive apartments on extensive grounds with potential for further development. For a second, I despised Lexi and me both, for schmoozing with this little skid mark for our own ends. I'm the smart one, I said. When you get the place, what are you going to do with all that potential? Ned gave me a baffled stare. Presumably he and Lexi had already talked about this. I gave him back a blank look, which seemed to make him feel at home.
Depends on plan and permission, yeah? I mean, ideally, I'll go for a golf club or a spa hotel, something like that. That's where the serious long-term profit is, especially if I can get a helipad put in. Otherwise, we're talking major luxury apartments.
I considered kicking him in the nads and running. I had gone in there already to hate this guy's guts, and he wasn't letting me down. Ned didn't want Whitethorn House. He didn't give a flying fuck about it, no matter what he had said in court. What had him salivating wasn't the house, but the thought of wrecking it, the chance to rip its throat out, scrape its ribs hollow, and lick up every last taste of blood. For a flash, I saw John Naylor's face, swollen and discoloured, lit up by those visionary eyes. Do you know what that hotel would have done for Glenskeehy? Deep down, deeper and more powerful than the fact that they would loathe each other's guts, he and Ned were two sides of the same coin. When they pack up their things and go, Naylor had said, I want to be there to wave them goodbye. At least he had been willing to put his body, not just his bank account, on the line for what he wanted.
Brilliant idea, I said. I mean, it's so important not to let a house just sit there being lived in.
Ned missed the sarcasm.
Obviously, he said hastily, in case I started looking for a bigger cut. It's going to take, like, a ton of investment cash just to get it off the ground, so 200's the best I can do. Are we good with that? Can I get the paperwork moving?
I pursed up my mouth and pretended to mull that one over.
I'll have to have a little think about it.
Oh, for fuck's sake!
Ned raked a hand through his quiff, frustrated, then smoothed it carefully back into shape.
Come on, this has been dragging on for, like, ever.
Sorry, I said, shrugging. If you were in such a major hurry, you should have made me a decent offer to start with.
Well, I am now, right? I've got investors lining up, begging to get in on the ground floor of this, but they won't hang around forever. These are serious guys, with serious money.
I gave him the smirk, with a bitchy little nose wrinkle thrown in. So I'll seriously let you know the exact second I decide, okay?
And I waved bye-bye. Ned stayed put for another few seconds, shifting from foot to foot and looking majorly pissed off. But I kept the glassy smirk going.
Right, he said finally. Fine, whatever. Let me know.
In the doorway, he turned to tell me impressively.
This could put me on the map, you know. This could have me playing with the big boys. So let's not fuck it up, okay?
He was trying for a dramatic exit, but he lost his chance by tripping over something as he turned to flounce off. He tried to save it by breaking into a jaunty little jog across the field, not looking back. I switched off my torch and waited there, in the cottage, while Ned sloshed through the grass and found his way back to his studmobile and panzered off towards civilization. The throb of the SUV tiny and meaningless against the huge night hillsides. Then I sat down against the wall of the outer room and felt my heart beat, where hers had finished beating. The air was soft and warm as cream. My arse went to sleep. Tiny moths whirled around me like petals. There were things growing beside me, out of the earth where she had bled. A pale clump of bluebells, a tiny sapling that looked like hawthorn. Things made of her. Even if Frank hadn't caught the live show,
He would hear that conversation in just a few hours, as soon as he got into work the next morning. I should have been on the phone to him, or Sam, or both, working out the best ways to use this. But I felt like if I moved or tried to talk or breathe too hard, my mind would spill over, soak away into the long grass. I had been so sure. Can you blame me? This girl like a wildcat gnawing off her own limbs sooner than be trapped. I had been positive that forever was the one word she would never say. I tried to tell myself she might have been planning to give the baby up for adoption, ditch the hospital as soon as she could walk, and vanish from the parking lot to the next promised land. But I knew. Those numbers she had been throwing around with Ned weren't for any hospital, no matter how fancy. They were for a life, for two lives. Just like she had let the others sculpt her delicately, unconsciously, into the little sister to round out their strange family. Just like she had let Ned shape her into the cliches that were all he understood. She had let me make her into what I was longing to see. A master key to open every slamming door, a never-ending freeway to a million clean starts. There's no such thing. Even this girl who left lives behind like rest stops had found her exit, in the end, and had been ready to take it. I sat in the cottage for a long time, with my fingers wrapped around the sapling, gently. It was so new. I didn't want to bruise it. I'm not sure how long it was before I managed to make myself stand up. I barely remember walking home. A part of me was actually hoping John Naylor would leap out of a hedge, blazing with his cause and looking for a screaming match or an all-out brawl. Just to give me something I could fight. The house was lit up like a Christmas tree, every window blazing, silhouettes flitting and a babble of voices pouring out. And for a moment, I couldn't take it in. Had something terrible happened? Was someone dying? Had the house tilted and sideslipped and tossed up some gay long-gone party? If I stepped onto the lawn, would I tumble straight into 1910? Then the gate clanged shut behind me, and Abby threw the French doors open, calling, "Lexi!" and came running down the grass, long white skirt streaming. "I was keeping an eye out for you," she said. She was breathless and flushed, eyes sparkling, and her hair starting to come loose from its clips. She had obviously been drinking. "We're being decadent. Rafe and Justin made this punch stuff with cognac and rum, and I don't know what else is in it, but it's lethal. And nobody has tutorials or anything tomorrow, so fuck it. We're not going into college. We're staying up drinking and making aegis of ourselves till we all fall over. Sound good?"
"Sounds brilliant," I said.
My voice came out strange, dislocated. It was taking me a while to pull myself together and catch up, but Abby didn't seem to notice.
"You think? See, at first I wasn't sure it was a good idea, but Rafe and Justin were already making the punch. Rafe set some kind of booze on fire, on purpose like, and they yelled at me for always worrying about everything. And, I mean, at least for once they're not bitching at each other, right? So I figured, what the hell, we need it. After the last few days, God, after the last few weeks, we've all been turning into crazy people. Did you realize that? That thing the other night with the rock and the fight and, Jesus."
Something crossed her face, a dark flicker, but before I could place it, it had vanished, and the reckless, tipsy gaiety was back.
"So I figure if we go completely nuts for tonight and get everything out of our systems, then maybe we can all chill out and go back to normal. What do you think?"
Being this drunk made her seem much younger. Somewhere in Frank's bomber-paced wargame mind, she and her three best friends were being lined up and inspected, one by one, inch by inch. He was evaluating them, cool as a surgeon or a torturer, deciding where to make the first test cut, where to insert the first delicate probe.
"I would love that," I said. "God, I'd love that."
"We started without you," Abby said, rearing back on her heels to inspect me anxiously. "You don't mind, do you, that we didn't wait for you?"
"Course not," I said,
"as long as there's some left." Far behind her, shadows crisscrossed on the living room wall, Rafe bent with a glass in one hand and his hair gold as a mirage against the dark curtains. And Josephine Baker poured out through the open windows, sweet and scratchy and beckoning. Mon rêve, c'était vous. In all my life I had seldom wanted anything as wildly as I wanted to be in there. Get this gun and this phone off me. Drink and dance until a fuse blew in my brain, and there was nothing left in the world except the music and the blaze of lights. And the four of them surrounding me, laughing, dazzling, untouchable.
Well, of course there's some left. What do you think we are?
She caught my wrist and headed back towards the house, pulling me behind her, twisting her skirt up off the grass with her free hand.
You have to help me with Daniel. He's got this big glass, but he's sipping it. Tonight isn't about sipping. He's supposed to be swigging. I mean, I know he's getting enough into him to do some good, because he went off into this whole long speech about the labyrinth and the minotaur and something with bottom and Midsummer Night's Dream, so he's not sober, but still.
Well, come on then, I said, laughing. I couldn't wait to see Daniel really hammered.
What are we waiting for?
And we raced up the lawn together and swept into the kitchen hand in hand. Justin was at the kitchen table with a ladle in one hand and a glass in the other, bending over a big fruit bowl full of something red and dangerous looking.
God, you're gorgeous, he told us. You're like a pair of little wood nymphs, so you are.
They are lovely, Daniel said, smiling at us from the doorway. Give them some punch, so they'll think we're lovely too.
We always think you're lovely, Abby told him, grabbing a glass from the table. But we need punch anyway. Lexi needs lots of punch, so she can catch up.
I'm lovely too, Rafe shouted from the sitting room, over Josephine.
Come in here and tell me I'm lovely.
You're lovely,
Abby and I yelled at the top of our lungs. And Justin pushed a glass into my hand, and we all headed into the sitting room, kicking off our shoes in the hall and licking off the punch that splashed onto our wrists and laughing. Daniel stretched out in one of the armchairs and Justin lay on the sofa, and Rafe and Abby and I ended up sprawled on the floor because chairs felt too complicated. Abby had been right. The punch was lethal, lovely, tricky stuff that went down as easy as fresh orange juice and then turned into a sweet, wild lightness, spreading like helium through every limb. I knew it would be a whole different story if I tried to do anything stupid, like stand up. I could hear Frank, somewhere in the back of my head, nagging about control, like one of the nuns from school droning on about the demon drink. But I was so bloody sick of Frank and his smart-arse little sound bites, and of being in control all the time.
More,
I demanded, nudging Justin with my foot and waving my glass at him. I don't remember big patches of that evening, not in detail. The second glass, or maybe the third, turned the whole night soft-edged and enchanted, something out of a dream. Somewhere in there I made some excuse to go up to my room and lock away my undercover paraphernalia. Gun, phone, girdle. Under the bed. Someone turned off most of the lights. All that was left was one lamp and candles scattered around like stars. I remember an in-depth argument over who was the best James Bond, leading into an equally intense one over which of the three guys would make the best James Bond. A deeply crap attempt at some drinking game called Fuzzy Duck that Rafe had learned in boarding school and that ended when Justin snorted punch down his nose and had to rush out and sneeze booze into the sink, laughing so hard that my stomach hurt and I had to stick my fingers in my ears till I could get my breath back. Rafe's arm flung out under Abby's neck, my feet propped on Justin's ankles, Abby reaching up a hand to take Daniel's. It was as if none of the jagged edges had ever existed. It was close and warm and shining as that first week again, only better, 100 times better. Because this time, I wasn't on the alert and fighting to get my bearings and stay in place. This time I knew them all by heart, their rhythms, their quirks, their inflections. I knew how to fit in with every one. This time I belonged. What I remember most is a conversation, just a tangent off something else, I don't know what, about Henry V. It didn't seem important at the time, but afterwards, After everything was over, it came back to me. The man was a raving psycho, Rafe said. He and I and Abby were lying on our backs on the floor again. He had his arm linked through mine. All that heroic Shakespeare stuff was pure propaganda. Today, Henry would be running a banana republic with serious border issues and a dodgy nuclear weapons program.
I like Henry, Daniel said through a cigarette. A king like that is exactly what we need.
Monarchist warmonger, said Abby to the ceiling. Come the revolution, you're up against the wall.
Neither monarchy nor war has ever been the real problem, said Daniel. Every society has always had war. It's intrinsic to humanity, and we've always had rulers. Do you really see so much difference between a medieval king and a modern-day president or prime minister, except that the king was marginally more accessible to his subjects? The real problem comes when the two things, monarchy and war, become dislocated from each other. With Henry, there was no disconnect.
You're babbling, Justin said. He was trying, with difficulty, to drink his punch without sitting up and without spilling it down his front. You know what you need, Abby told him. A straw, a bendy one.
Yes, said Justin, delighted. I do need a bendy straw. Do we have any?
No, said Abby, surprised, which for some reason sent me and Rafe into helpless, undignified giggles.
I'm not babbling, Daniel said. Look at the old wars, centuries ago. The king led his men into battle, always. That was what the ruler was, both on a practical level and on a mystical one. He was the one who stepped forward to lead his tribe, put his life at stake for them, become the sacrifice for their safety. If he had refused to do that most crucial thing at that most crucial moment, they would have ripped him apart, and rightly so. He would have shown himself to be an impostor with no right to the throne. The king was the country. How could he possibly expect it to go into battle without him? But now, can you see any modern president or prime minister on the front line leading his men into the war he started? And once that physical and mystical link is broken, once the ruler is no longer willing to be the sacrifice for his people, he becomes not a leader, but a leech, forcing others to take his risks while he sits in safety and battens on their losses. War becomes a hideous abstraction, a game for bureaucrats to play on paper. Soldiers and civilians become mere pawns, to be sacrificed by the thousand for reasons that have no roots in any reality. As soon as rulers mean nothing, war means nothing. Human life means nothing. We're ruled by venal little usurpers, all of us, and they make meaninglessness everywhere they go.
Do you know something? I told him, managing to lift my head a few inches off the floor. I only have maybe a quarter of a clue what you're talking about. How are you this sober?
He's not sober, said Abby with satisfaction.
Rants mean he's drunk. You should know that by now. Daniel is ossified.
It's not a rant, Daniel said, but he was smiling at her, a mischievous flash of a grin. It's a monologue. If Hamlet can have them, why can't I?
At least I understand the Hamlet rants, I said plaintively. Mostly.
What he's saying, basically, Rafe informed me, turning his head on the hearthrug so that those gold eyes were inches from mine, is that politicians are overrated. That picnic on the hill, months before, Rafe and me throwing strawberries to shut Daniel up in the middle of another rant. I swear I remembered it. The smell of the sea breeze, the ache of my thighs from climbing.
Everything's overrated except Elvis and chocolate, I announced, raising my glass precariously above my head, and heard Daniel's sudden, irresistible laugh.
Drink suited Daniel. It put a vivid flush on his cheekbones and a spark deep in his eyes, loosened his stiffness into a sure animal grace.
Usually Rafe was the resident eye candy. But that night, it was Daniel I couldn't take my eyes off. Leaning back among the candle flames and the rich colours and the faded brocade of the chair, with the glass glowing red in his hand and dark hair fallen across his forehead, he looked like some ancient war leader himself. A high king in his banquet hall, shining and reckless, celebrating between battles. The sash windows flung open to the night garden, moths whirling at the lights, shadows crisscrossing, soft damp breeze playing in the curtains.
"But it's summer," Justin said suddenly, amazed, shooting up on the sofa. "Feel the wind. It's warm. It's summer. Come on. Come outside."
And he scrambled up, tugging Abby up by the hand as he went past, and clambered out the window onto the patio. The garden was dark and scented and alive. I don't know how long we spent out there, under a huge wild moon. Rafe and me crossing hands and whirling on the lawn till we fell over in a panting, giggling heap. Justin tossing a great double handful of hawthorn petals in the air so that they fell like snow onto our hair. Daniel and Abby dancing a slow, barefoot waltz under the trees, like ghost lovers from some long-lost ball. I threw flips and cartwheels straight across the grass. Fuck my imaginary stitches. Fuck whether Lexi had done gymnastics. I couldn't remember the last time I had been this drunk, and I loved it. I wanted to dive deeper into it and never come up for air, open my mouth and take a huge breath and drown on this night. I lost the others, somewhere along the way. I was lying on my back in the herb garden, smelling crushed mint and looking up at a million dizzy stars on my own. I could hear Rafe calling my name, faintly, at the front of the house. After a while, I picked myself up and went to find him, but gravity had somehow gone slippery, and it was hard to walk. I felt my way along the wall, keeping one hand on branches and ivy. I heard twigs snap under my bare feet, but there wasn't even a flicker of pain. The lawn was white in the moonlight. Music streamed out through the windows, and Abby was dancing by herself on the grass, spinning slow circles, her arms outspread and her head back to the enormous night sky. I stood by the alcove, swinging a long trail of ivy with one hand, and watched her. The pale swirl and dip of her skirt, the turn of her wrist holding it up, the arch of her bare foot, the dreamy drunken sway of her neck in and out of the whispering trees.
"Isn't she beautiful?" said a voice softly behind me. I was way too drunk even to be startled. It was Daniel, on one of the stone seats under the ivy, with a glass in his hand and a bottle and the flagstones beside him. The moon shadows turned him into carved marble. "When we're all old and grey, and starting to slip away, even if I've forgotten everything else my life has ever held, I think I'll remember her like this." A swift, painful pang went through me, but I couldn't figure out why. It was much too complicated, too far away. "I want to remember tonight too," I said. "I want to tattoo it onto me so I don't forget."
"Come here," Daniel said. He put the glass down and moved sideways on the bench to make room, held out a hand to me.
"Come here. We'll have thousands more nights like this. You can forget them by the dozen if you want to. We'll make more. We've got all the time in the world."
His hand around mine was warm, strong. He pulled me down on the seat and I leaned in against him, that solid shoulder, smell of cedar and clean wool, everything black and silver and shifting, and the water murmuring on and on at our feet.
"When I thought we'd lost you," Daniel said, "it was..."
He shook his head, took a quick breath like a gasp.
"I missed you. You have no idea how much. But it's all right now. Everything's going to be all right."
He turned towards me. His hand came up,
fingers tangling in my hair, rough and tender, moving down across my cheek, tracing the line of my mouth. The lights of the house spun blurred and magic as the lights of a carousel. There was a high singing note above the trees, and the ivy was whirling with music so sweet I could hardly bear it. And all I wanted in the world was to stay. Strip off the mic and the wire, into an envelope and down the postbox to Frank and gone. Skim off my old life light as a bird and home straight here. We didn't want to lose you, silly thing. The others would be happy. The rest of our lives they would never need to know. I had as much right as the dead girl. I was Lexi Madison as much as she had ever been. My landlord thrown my awful work clothes into bin liners when the rent dried up. There was nothing there I would need now. Cherry blossom falling soft on the drive, quiet smell of old books, firelight sparkling on snow-crystalled windowpanes at Christmas time, and nothing would ever change. Only the five of us moving through this walled garden. Never ending. Somewhere far in the back of my mind, a drum was throbbing hard for danger. But I knew like a vision that this was why the dead girl had come a million miles to find me. This was why Lexi Madison, all along. To wait for her moment to hold out her hand and take mine. Lead me up those stone steps and in by that door, lead me home. Daniel's mouth tasted of ice and whiskey. If I'd thought about it, I would have expected Daniel to be a fairly crap kisser, in a meticulous kind of way. The fierceness of him took my breath away. When we pulled apart, I don't know how much later, my heart was running wild. And now, I thought, with one tiny clear drop of my mind, what happens now? Daniel's mouth, the corners curving in a tiny smile, was very close to mine. His hands were on my shoulders, his thumbs moving in long, gentle strokes along the line of my collarbone. Frank wouldn't have batted an eyelid. I know undercovers who've slept with gangsters, given out beatings and shot up heroin, all in the name of the job. I never said anything. Not my business. But I knew well that was bollocks. There's always another way to what you're after, if you want to find it. They did those things because they wanted to, and because the job gave them an excuse. In that second, I saw Sam's face in front of me, eyes wide and stunned, clear as if he was standing at Daniel's elbow. It should have made me cringe with shame, but all I felt was a wave of pure frustration, smashing over me so hard I wanted to scream. He was like this enormous feather duvet wrapped all around my life, smothering me to nothing with holidays and protective questions and gentle, inexorable warmth. I wanted to fling him off with one violent buck and take a huge breath of cold air all my own again. It was the wire that saved me. Not what it might pick up. I wasn't thinking that straight. But Daniel's hands. His thumbs were maybe 3 inches from the mic, clipped to my bra between my breasts. In one blink, I was as sober as I'd ever been in my life. I was 3 inches away from burned. "Well," I said, stalling, and gave Daniel a little grin. "It's always the quiet ones." He didn't move. I thought I saw a flick of something in his eyes, but I couldn't tell what. My brain seemed to have seized up. I had no idea how Lexi would have got herself out of this one. I had a horrible feeling that she wouldn't have. There was a crash inside the house. The French doors banged open, and someone erupted onto the patio. Rafe was yelling. "Always have to make such a huge fucking deal out of everything. My God, that's rich coming from you. You were the one who wanted to." It was Justin, and he was so furious his voice was shaking. I widened my eyes at Daniel, jumped up and peeped out through the ivy. Rafe was pacing up and down the patio and raking a hand through his hair. Justin was slumped against the wall, biting hard at a nail. They were still fighting, but their voices had dropped a notch, and all I could hear was the fast, vicious rhythms. The angle of Justin's head, chin tucked into his chest, looked like he might be crying. "Shit," I said, glancing back over my shoulder at Daniel. He was still on the bench, his face blurred into the patterns of leaf shadow. I couldn't see his expression. "I think they broke something inside, and Rafe looks like he might hit Justin. Maybe we should..." He stood up, slowly. The black and white of him seemed to fill the alcove, tall and sharp and strange. "Yes," he said. "We probably should." He moved me out of the way with a gentle, impersonal hand on my shoulder and went out across the lawn. Abby had collapsed on her back in the grass in a whirl of white cotton, one arm flung out. She looked fast asleep. Daniel knelt on one knee beside her and carefully hooked a lock of her hair off her face. Then he straightened up again, brushing bits of grass off his trousers, and went to the patio. Rafe yelled, "Jesus Christ!" spun round and stormed inside, slamming the door behind him. Justin was definitely crying now. None of it made any sense. The whole incomprehensible scene seemed to be moving in slow, tilting circles, the house reeling helplessly, the garden heaving like water. I realized that I wasn't sober after all. In fact, I was spectacularly drunk. I sat down on the bench and put my head between my knees till things stayed still. I must have gone to sleep or passed out. I don't know. I heard shouting somewhere, but it didn't seem to have anything to do with me, and I let it go by. A crick in my neck woke me. It took me a long time to work out where I was. Curled on the stone seat, with my head tilted back against the wall at an undignified angle. My clothes were clammy and cold, and I was shivering. I unfurled myself in stages and stood up. Bad move. My head went into a sickening spin. I had to grab at the ivy to stay vertical. Outside the alcove, the garden had turned grey. A still, ghostly pre-dawn grey. Not a leaf moving. For a second, I was afraid to step out into it. It looked like a place that shouldn't be disturbed. Abby was gone from the lawn. The grass was heavy with dew, soaking my feet and the hems of my jeans. Someone's socks, possibly mine, were tangled on the patio, but I didn't have the energy to pick them up. The French doors were swinging open, and Rafe was asleep on the sofa, snoring, in a puddle of full ashtrays and empty glasses and scattered cushions and the smell of stale booze. The piano was speckled with shards of broken glass, curving and wicked on the glossy wood and the yellowing keys. And there was a deep, fresh gouge on the wall above it. Someone had thrown something, a glass or an ashtray, and meant it. I tiptoed upstairs and crawled into bed without bothering to take off my clothes. It was a long time before I could stop shivering and fall asleep. Chapter 19. Unsurprisingly, we all woke up late, with hangovers from hell and a collective foul mood. My head was killing me, even my hair hurt, and my mouth had that walk of shame feel, swollen and tender. I pulled a sweater over yesterday's clothes, checked the mirror for stubble burn, nothing, and dragged myself downstairs. Abby was in the kitchen, smacking ice cubes into a glass. "Sorry," I said in the doorway. "Did I miss breakfast?" She threw the ice tray back into the freezer and slammed the door. "Nobody's hungry. I'm having a Bloody Mary. Daniel made coffee if you want anything else. You can get it yourself." She brushed past me and went into the sitting room. I figured if I tried to work out why she was pissed off at me, my head might explode. I poured myself a lot of coffee, buttered a slice of bread, toast felt way too complicated, and took them into the sitting room. Rafe was still unconscious on the sofa, with a cushion pulled over his head. Daniel was sitting on the windowsill, staring out at the garden, with a mug in one hand and a cigarette burning away forgotten in the other. He didn't look around.
"Can he breathe?"
I asked, pointing at Rafe with my chin.
"Who cares?" said Abby.
She was slumped in an armchair with her eyes closed and her glass pressed to her forehead. The air smelled musty and overripe, cigarette butts and sweat and spilled booze. Someone had cleaned the shards of glass off the piano. They were in a corner of the floor, in a small, threatening pile. I sat down, carefully, and tried to eat without moving my head. The afternoon oozed on, slow and sticky as treacle. Abby played half-hearted solitaire, giving up and starting over every few minutes. I dozed off and on, curled in the armchair. Justin finally appeared, wrapped in his dressing gown, eyelids fluttering with pain at the light coming through the windows. It was sort of a nice day if you were in the mood for that kind of thing.
"Oh, God," he said faintly, shielding his eyes. "My head. I think I'm getting the flu. I ache everywhere."
"Night air," said Abby, dealing another hand. "Cold, damp, whatever. Not to mention enough punch to float a cruise ship."
"It is not the punch. My legs hurt. A hangover doesn't make your legs hurt. Can't we close the curtains?"
"No," said Daniel, without turning around. "Have some coffee."
"Maybe I'm having a brain hemorrhage. Don't they do things to your eyes?"
"You have a hangover," Rafe said from the depths of the sofa. "And if you don't stop whining, I'm going to come over there and throttle you, even if it kills me too."
"Oh, great," Abby said, massaging the bridge of her nose. "It's alive."
Justin ignored him with an icy lift of his chin that said last night's fight wasn't over, and sank into a chair.
"Maybe we should think about going out at some point," Daniel said, finally coming out of his reverie and looking around. "It might help to clear our heads."
"I can't go anywhere," Justin said, reaching for Abby's Bloody Mary. "I have the flu. If I go out, I'll get pneumonia."
Abby slapped his hand away. "I'm drinking that. Make your own."
"The ancients would have said," Daniel told him, "that you were suffering from an imbalance of the humors, an excess of black bile causing melancholy. Black bile is cold and dry, so to counter it, you need something warm and moist. I don't remember which foods are associated with sanguinity, but it seems logical that red meat, for example."
"Sartre was right," Rafe said through his cushion. "Hell is other people."
I felt the same way. All I wanted was for it to be evening so I could go for my walk, get out of this house and away from these people and try to wrap my head around the night before. I had never in all my life spent so much of my time surrounded by people. Up until that day, it hadn't even registered. But all of a sudden, everything they did, Justin's dying swan act, the snap of Abby's cards, felt like a full-on assault. I pulled my sweater over my head, burrowed into the corner of the armchair, and went to sleep. When I woke up, the room was empty. It looked like it had been abandoned fast in some sudden emergency. Lamps on, shades tilted at odd angles, chairs pushed back, half-empty mugs and sticky rings on the table. "Hi," I called, but my voice soaked away into the shadows and no one answered. The house felt huge and unwelcoming, the way a house sometimes does when you come back downstairs after you've closed up for the night. Alien, withdrawn, focused on its own private business. No note anywhere. The others had probably gone for a walk after all, to blow the hangovers away. I poured myself a mug of cold coffee and drank it leaning against the kitchen sink, looking out the window. The light was just starting to turn gold and syrupy, and swallows were diving and chittering across the lawn. I left my mug in the sink and went up to my room, involuntarily walking quietly and skipping the creaky stair. As I put my hand on the door handle, I felt the house gather itself and tense around me. Even before I opened the door, before I smelt the faint wisp of tobacco smoke on the air and saw his silhouette sitting broad-shouldered and motionless on the bed, I knew Daniel was home. The light through the curtains glinted blue on his glasses as he turned his head to me. "Who are you?" he asked. I thought as fast as even Frank could ever want for me. I already had one finger on my mouth to shut him up while my other hand smacked the light switch, and then I called, "Hey, it's me, I'm out here." And thanked God Daniel was weird enough that we might just possibly get away with that "who are you?" His eyes were intent on my face, and he was between me and my case. "Where is everyone?" I asked him, and ripped open the buttons of my top so he could see the tiny mic clipped to my bra, the wire running down into the white pad of bandage. Daniel's eyebrows lifted just a touch. "They went to see a film in town," he said calmly. "I had a few things I needed to do here. We decided not to wake you." I nodded, gave him the thumbs up, and knelt down slowly to pull my case out from under the bed, not taking my eyes off him. The music box on the bedside table, solid and sharp-cornered and within reach. That should slow him down long enough to get me out of there if I needed it. But Daniel didn't move. I dialed the combination, opened the case, found my ID and threw it to him. He inspected it closely. "Did you sleep well?" he asked formally. He had his head bent over the ID, apparently absorbed in it, and my hand was on the bedside table inches from my gun. But if I went to slip it into my waistband and he looked up, no. I zipped the case shut and locked it. "Not great," I said. "My head is still killing me. I'm going to go read for a while and hope it gets better. See you in a bit." I waved a hand to get Daniel's attention. Then I moved towards the door and beckoned. He gave my ID one last look, then laid it carefully on the bedside table. "Yes," he said. "I'm sure I'll see you later." He got up from the bed and followed me downstairs. He moved very silently for such a big guy. I could feel him at my back all the way, and I knew I should be scared. One push. But I wasn't. Adrenaline was flying through me like wildfire, and I've never been less afraid in my life. "Rapture of the deep," Frank called it once, and warned me not to trust it. Undercovers can drown like deep-sea divers on the ecstasy of weightlessness, but I didn't care. Daniel stood in the sitting room doorway watching me with interest, while I hummed, "Oh, Johnny, how can you love," under my breath, and flipped through the records. I picked out Faure's Requiem, stacked it up over the string sonatas. Frank might as well have something good to listen to, broaden his cultural horizons, and I doubted he had noticed the midstream switch, and turned it up to a nice, solid volume. I flopped into my chair with a thump, sighed contentedly, and flipped a few pages of my notebook. Then very carefully, I peeled off the bandage strip by strip, unclipped the mic from my bra, and left the whole package on the chair to listen to music for a while. Daniel followed me through the kitchen and out the French doors. I didn't like the idea of crossing the open lawn. "You won't have visual surveillance," Frank had told me. But he would have said that either way. But we didn't have a choice. I skirted around the edge and got us in among the trees. Once we were out of view, I relaxed enough to remember my buttons and do them up again. If Frank did have someone watching, that would have given him something to think about. The alcove was brighter than I had expected. The light slanted long and gold across the grass, slipped between the creepers and glowed in patches on the paving stones. The seat was cold even through my jeans. The ivy swayed back into place to hide us. "Okay," I said. "We can talk, but keep it down just in case." Daniel nodded. He brushed flecks of dirt off the other seat and sat down. Lexi is dead, then, he said. I'm afraid so, I said. I'm sorry. It sounded ludicrously, insanely inadequate on about a million levels. When? The night she was stabbed. She wouldn't have suffered much if that's any comfort. He didn't respond. He clasped his hands in his lap and gazed out through the ivy. At our feet, the trickle of water murmured. Cassandra Maddox, Daniel said eventually, trying out the sound of it. I wondered quite a lot about that, you know. What your real name was. It suits you. I go by Cassie, I said. He ignored that. Why did you take off your microphone? With someone else, I might have skated around this, parried it. Why do you think? But not with Daniel. I want to know what happened to Lexi. I don't care whether anyone else hears it or not. And I thought you would be more likely to tell me if I gave you a reason to trust me. Either out of politeness or out of indifference, he didn't point out the irony. And you think I know how she died? He inquired. Yes, I said. I do. Daniel considered this. Shouldn't you be afraid of me, in that case? Maybe, but I'm not. He scrutinized me for a long moment. You're very like Lexi, you know, he said. Not only physically, but temperamentally as well. At first I wondered if I simply wanted to believe that, to excuse the fact that I had been fooled for so long. But it's true. Lexi was fearless. She was like an ice skater balanced effortlessly on the edge of her own speed, throwing in joyous, elaborate twirls and leaps just for the hell of it. I always envied her that. His eyes were in shadow and I couldn't read his expression. Was this just for the hell of it, if I may ask? No, I said. At first, I didn't even want to do it. It was Detective Mackey's idea. He thought it was necessary to the investigation. Daniel nodded, unsurprised. He suspected us from the beginning, he said, and I realized that he was right. Of course he was right. All Frank's talk about the mysterious foreigner who followed Lexi halfway across the world, that was just a smokescreen. Sam would have thrown a blue fit if he thought I was going to share a roof with the killer. Frank's famous intuition had kicked in long before we ever got into that squad room. He had known, all along, that the answer was in this house. He's an interesting man, Detective Mackey, Daniel said. He's like one of those charming murderers in Jacobean plays, the ones who get all the best monologues. Ursula or De Flores. It's a pity you can't tell me anything. I would be fascinated to know how much he's guessed. So would I said. Believe me. Daniel took out his cigarette case, opened it, and politely offered it to me. His face bent over the lighter as I cupped my hand around the flame, was absorbed and untroubled. Now, he said, when he had lit his own smoke and put the case away. I'm sure you have some questions you'd like to ask me. If I'm so much like Lexi, I said, what gave me away? I couldn't help it. It wasn't professional pride or anything. I just needed badly to know what that unmissable difference had been. Daniel turned his head and looked at me. There was an expression on his face that I hadn't expected. Something almost like affection or sympathy. You did extraordinarily well, you know, he said kindly. Even now, I don't think the others suspect anything. We'll have to decide what to do about that, you and I. I can't have done all that well, I said, or he wouldn't be here. He shook his head.
I think that underrates both of us, don't you?
You were virtually flawless.
I did know almost immediately that something was wrong. All of us did. Just as you would sense something amiss if your partner were replaced by his identical twin. But there were so many possible reasons for that. At first, I wondered if you might be faking the amnesia for reasons of your own, but gradually it became clear that your memory was, in fact, damaged. There seemed to be no reason why you should pretend to forget about finding that photo album, for example. And it was obvious that you were genuinely disturbed by the fact that you didn't remember it. Once I was satisfied that that wasn't the problem, I thought perhaps you were planning to leave, which would have been understandable in the circumstances, but Abby seemed very sure that you weren't, and I trust Abby's judgment. And you really did seem... His face turned towards me. You really did seem happy, you know. More than happy. Content. Settled. Nested back in among us as if you had never been away. Perhaps this was deliberate, and you're even better at your job than I realize. But I find it hard to believe that both my instincts and Abby's could have been quite so wrong. There was nothing I could say to that. For a split second, I wanted to curl up in a ball and howl at the top of my lungs, like a kid devastated by the sheer ruthlessness of this world. I gave Daniel a non-committal tilt of my chin, drew on my smoke, and tapped ash onto the flagstones. Daniel waited with a grave patience that sent a little warning chill through me. When it was clear that I wasn't going to answer, he nodded, a tiny, private, thoughtful nod. At any rate, he said, I decided you, or rather Lexi, must simply be traumatized. A profound trauma, and clearly this would qualify, can transform a person's entire character, you know. Turn a strong person into a trembling wreck, a happy nature, melancholic, a gentle one, vicious. It can shatter you into a million pieces and rearrange the remains in an utterly unrecognizable form. His voice was even, calm. He was looking away from me again, out at the hawthorn flowers white and shivering in the breeze, and I couldn't see his eyes. The changes in Lexi were so small by comparison, so trivial, so easily accounted for. I assume Detective Mackey gave you the information you needed. Detective Mackey and Lexi. The videophone. Daniel thought about that for so long that I thought he had forgotten my question. There was an inbuilt immobility to his face, that square-cut jaw maybe, that made it almost impossible to read. Everything's overrated, except Elvis and chocolate, he said in the end. That was a nice touch. Was it the onions that did it? I asked. He drew in a breath and stirred, coming out of his reverie. Those onions, he said with a faint smile. Lexi was fanatical about them. Onions and cabbage. Fortunately, none of the rest of us like cabbage either. But we had to reach a compromise on the onions. Once a week. She still complained and picked them out and so on. Mainly to tease Rafe and Justin, I think. So when you ate them without a murmur and asked for more, I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what, exactly. You covered it very well. But I couldn't simply dismiss it. The only alternative explanation I could come up with was that, incredible though it seemed, you weren't Lexi. So you set a trap for me, I said. The Brogans thing. Well, I wouldn't call it a trap, Daniel said with a touch of asperity. More of a test. It was a spur-of-the-moment thing. Lexi had no particular feelings about Brogans either way. I'm not sure she'd ever been there, which didn't seem like something an imposter would know. You might have found out her likes and dislikes, but hardly her indifferences. The fact that you got it right, and the Elvis comment, reassured me, but then there was last night. That kiss. I went cold all over, till I remembered I didn't have the mic on.
Lexi wouldn't have done that? I asked, coolly, leaning over to put out my smoke on the flagstones.
Daniel smiled at me, that slow, sweet smile that made him suddenly handsome.
Oh, she would have, he said. The kiss was very much in character, and very nice, if I may say so.
I didn't blink.
No, it was your reaction to it. For a split second you looked stunned, utterly shocked at what you had done. Then you recovered and made some airy comment, and found an excuse to move away. But, you see, Lexi would never have been shaken by that kiss, not even for a second. And she would certainly never have drawn back at that point. She would have been.
He blew thoughtful smoke rings up into the ivy.
She would have been, he said. Triumphant.
Why? I asked. Had she been trying to make something like that happen? My mind was fast-forwarding through the video clips. There had been flirting with Rafe and Justin, but never with Daniel, not a hint. But that could have been a bluff to mislead the others.
That, Daniel said, is what gave you away.
I stared at him. He ground out the cigarette under his foot.
Lexi was both incapable of thinking about the past, he said, and incapable of thinking more than one step into the future. This may be one of the few things you overlooked. Not your fault. That level of simplicity is hard to imagine, and also hard to describe. It was as startling as a deformity. I seriously doubt that she would have been able to plan a seduction, but once something had happened, she would have seen no reason to be shocked by it, and certainly no reason to stop there. You, on the other hand, were clearly trying to gauge the consequences this might have. I'd guess that you have a boyfriend or a partner in your own life.
I didn't say anything.
So, Daniel said, I rang the police headquarters this afternoon, once the others had gone out, and asked where I could find Detective Sam O'Neill. The woman I spoke to couldn't find an extension for him at first, but then she checked some directory and gave me a number to ring. She said, that's the murder squad room.
He sighed, a small, tired, final sound.
Murder, he said quietly. So then, you see, I knew.
I'm sorry, I said again. All day while we drank coffee and got on each other's nerves and bitched about our hangovers, while he sent the others off to the pictures and sat in Lexi's small, dimming bedroom waiting for me, he had been carrying this alone.
Daniel nodded.
Yes, he said.
I see that.
There was a long silence. Finally, I said, you know, I need to ask you what happened. Daniel took off his glasses and polished them on his handkerchief. Without them, his eyes looked blank, blind.
There's a Spanish proverb, he said, that's always fascinated me. Take what you want and pay for it, says God.
The words fell into the silence under the ivy like cool pebbles into water, sank without a ripple.
I don't believe in God, Daniel said, but that principle seems to me to have a divinity of its own, a kind of blazing purity. What could possibly be simpler or more crucial? You can have anything you want as long as you accept that there is a price, and that you will have to pay it.
He put the glasses on and looked at me calmly, tucking the handkerchief back into his shirt pocket.
It seems to me, he said, that we as a society have come to overlook the second clause. We hear only, take what you want, says God,
Nobody mentions a price, and when it comes time to settle the score, everyone's outraged. Take the national economic